supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Grapple, and I'm Naomi Sterobin. The coal industry, it's not what it was back in the day.
When the mills closed down, the mines closed down. We will never quit using coal, but I don't think coal ever come back to where it was.
But some people, like President Donald Trump, do envision a comeback.
And we're going to put our coal miners back to work.
And in southwestern Pennsylvania, where there's a long history of coal mining, Trump won. Some coal miners, though, worry that the president's plan will leave them behind.
President Trump released some regulations on the burning of coal, the emissions, but that's helping coal companies, it's not helping coal miners.
On the show today, what coal miners are grappling with. We're going to hear some stories from our reporter, Margaret J. Krause, a mine rescue team, a retired coal miner worried about his future, and a former miner who had to find new work. Our first story takes us right into the dangers of coal mining. It's an inherently risky endeavor, big machines in close quarters surrounded by flammable material, both on the surface and deep underground. While mining disasters are rare, they still do happen, and the people trained to respond to those emergencies are other coal miners, who often practice by going to rescue competitions.
The best things that we could do to try to train the teams should the actual event happen, and so it teaches the teams to work together, to do the things, and to develop skills so that they can go into a hazardous situation, which that's what they train to do, and be okay.
Margaret checked out one of those competitions in Rough Creek. It's a community in the southwestern corner of Pennsylvania, not too far from the West Virginia border.
Thank you, sir. Jimmy, how you doing?
Good.
Without the rescue team's headlamps, the coal mine was dark. The kind of dark that made me feel like I was floating, because I couldn't tell where my body was in space.
The tracking system is showing Danny and 24 cross cut between 2 and 3 inches, and Rick.
The team was looking for trapped miners. One rescuer was in the command center.
In by 25 cross cut and number 1 entry.
He was guiding his guys through the crosscuts. There was smoke and ankle-deep water in there, bad air, possibly a fire.
Well, the whole thing is with the mine rescue guys, and that's what my wife doesn't understand about me, is we're going in a coal mine that everybody's running out of.
That's Don Kreck. He created this emergency, which isn't real. It's part of the competition. Most coal mines, if they're big enough, have mine rescue teams. They train 96 hours a year, at minimum, preparing to respond to emergencies. Roof collapse, explosions, fires, you name it.
What else you got wrong with him, kitty? Anything life-threatening?
Mine rescue teams are the volunteer firefighters of coal mining. There's no extra pay for being on a team, no bonus, just hours of drills, and the knowledge that anything could go wrong at any time, and they're the ones on call. Don said mine rescue teams aren't heroes. They're just regular guys who have the training to do what needs to be done.
So I guess you just will yourself to do things in life. I was responsible for the guys behind me. I knew their wives, their families, their kids. I never let them down. Thankfully, I never had to, so. But that's what we do. I don't know.
During the competition, teams worked against the clock in 4 timed events. Mine rescue, smoke exploration, first aid support skills, and firefighting. Early in the morning, at one of the firefighting stations, I met some of the coal miners who were competing, like Austin Ponseroff. Growing up, he used to go to competitions with his dad, who's still part of a mine rescue team.
Yeah, my mom flipped out whenever I wanted to do this, you know. I said, well, look at it this way. If dad's ever stuck in a mine, who do you want going after him? I said, the same person I want coming after me. You know what I mean? That's why I do it, because of these guys, you know.
Austin and his teammates work at Harvey Mine in Sycamore, Pennsylvania. They had a little time to kill before their first exercise, so they were watching another team suit up for the live burn, i.e. putting out a blazing fire in an enclosed space. The tin hangar that housed the exercise sat on the edge of some woods. The morning mist seemed to be pretty slow burning off, even though it was almost 7:30. Then I realized that mist was smoke seeping out of the building. The guys pulled on their oxygen masks, and a judge walked over to a control panel. Then there was a rush of sound, like the pilot light of a huge gas stove being ignited. I looked back at Austin and his buddies. One guy was explaining to a teammate why it was important that your suit cover your entire body. A few others were just watching the exercise unfold. Another couple guys were chatting about their kids' baseball games, a doubleheader coming up. They were leaning casually on a white propane tank, feeding the fire inside the hangar. Roughly 150 feet away from a structure purposely being lit on fire, they were draped over a highly flammable object. Is that just a giant propane tank, I asked?
Yes, it is.
If it blows up, we can't save you on that.
It's been 7 years since Austin got his first mining job. He needed the benefits, like insurance and a reliable schedule.
I had two children, and I had a third one on the way, and you can't make any money doing construction. I mean, you can, but not working 9 months a year, so I pursued this career. I enjoy it, though. I really do. I like what I do on a daily basis, and I really enjoy doing this.
Back inside the simulation mine, Don explained how the mine rescue part of the competition worked. Teams were given an incident, the description of a scenario they were about to face, and then sent into the mine.
We'll be coming down here next.
Don was on a rescue team for 25 of the 38 years he spent in the coal mines. He said the one thing he never did in an emergency was watch what the TV people had to say about it.
I keep my head clear, and I try to tell my guys, the rest of the team, that, you know, don't watch it, but they do. Hey, this guy has heard this, heard that. I said, I don't care what you heard. I said, when we get there, when they call and tell us, come to the mine, I said, we'll go in, we'll get briefed, and then we'll go from there.
During the competition, they didn't pump smoke or water into the mine. Instead, Don pointed out pieces of laminated paper laid on the crushed stone floor. They said things like ankle-deep water or carbon monoxide with a concentration printed below. The placards alerted teams to changing conditions they needed to watch and adjust for. As Don walked, the floor threw little puffs of dust into the beam of his light, visible against black plywood walls.
So I started in 1980. Our first real-life practice was at a real coal mine. So, you know, you had your contest training, but a contest training is nothing like real life or anything like that. We learned the hard way.
Breaking news out of West Virginia. Tonight, 12 of the miners trapped for nearly 42 hours after an explosion underground.
On January 2nd, 2006, Don got a call. There'd been an accident in Sago, West Virginia, about 4 hours away.
Five men went to work in the first section, 13 others in the second. That's where an explosion apparently rocked the mine.
We got up where the explosion was at its fiercest, and there's a lot of carnage up there, a lot of things misplaced, so to speak, with the force of an explosion. And I don't talk about Sago. I can't.
It wasn't Don's first rescue call, by any stretch, but it's the one he mentions when he talks about being ready at a moment's notice. Ultimately, 12 men died in the Sago mine disaster. The rescue teams were only able to save one.
When you're in a real event, no matter if you're physically exhausted, mentally, you have to be sharp.
Don is retired now, but he jumped at the chance to continue training mine rescue teams at these kinds of competitions. He hopes these guys never have to respond to a real emergency. But if they do, he wants them to be ready. Don observed the teams working through the mine rescue problem. One group had just identified a trapped miner. The air was bad. The sound of all the team members talking through their oxygen masks made my heart race, like something awful really had happened.
What they have now, they have a guy to rescue.
Don was holding a map of the mine, and he showed me the conditions the team was up against.
You get blocked here, you got to figure out how to get back out now to the elevator. But the thing is, where they're going to get docked, discounted right now, that patient that they got out over there, they're going to walk him right into low oxygen.
In other words, that guy isn't getting enough oxygen, and he's likely going to die. This is what Don was talking about. He likes to throw curveballs at the end of a long day to keep things as real as possible.
I'll do it every time, only because I love them. That's what I tell them. Guys, I only do this because I love you, man. I said, when you leave here and you get called next day to go to a real event, I want it to be easy for you.
He looked at the map and back at the team. They were standing in a circle discussing whether or not they needed to ventilate this part of the mine. Don shook his head, disappointed.
And it's up to them. It's up to them, and they're not sharp. These guys aren't sharp at all.
When coal mining was at its peak in Pennsylvania in 1918, the state produced more than 30% of the nation's coal and employed about 330,000 people. Throughout the 20th century, coal from Pennsylvania helped fuel two world wars and helped build the nation's bridges, highways, and skyscrapers. But the industry started to decline after World War II, with some ups and downs along the way, and then by the mid-1980s, the industry hit a record low. It bounced back a bit, but never fully recovered, and as of 2015, fewer than 7,000 people worked in Pennsylvania's coal mines. Today, the state produces only 6% of the nation's coal. Pretty big contrast to when miners like Dave Vansickle were just starting out in the mid-1970s.
If you were going to stay in this area without going to college, you basically had to get a job in a mine or the mill. I mean, that was what was here in this area. This whole area was built on, you know, the backs of coal miners, I guess.
Today, Dave is 61. He retired only a few years ago. He spent his whole career working in the coal industry, and now he's among the 17,000 retired union miners living in the state who rely on pension and health benefits guaranteed by the companies they once worked for. Essentially, Dave's life has revolved around coal. He even grew up around it. His father and grandfather were also miners. And so for him, coal has always provided a living for his family, even during tough economic times. Margaret spent an afternoon talking with Dave about his experience at his home in Uniontown, just an hour southeast of Pittsburgh, where he lives with his wife, Sandy.
The first thing that struck me about Dave and Sandy's house, after their dogs, is how spotless it is. I learned later that Dave had always wanted a house to be proud of.
Yeah, it was rough growing up. You know, back then the mines didn't pay. It gave me good life's lessons, which made me say that I was going to do better. You know, I was going to have a home that I was proud to bring someone to, that my kids could bring people over anytime they wanted to, just give them a life that I never had.
Dave grew up about 12 miles from here in a community called Woodside. All the houses look the same. They had four rooms and a basement.
This whole area was comprised of coal patches. Every little patch seemed to have its own mine. It's like every steel company, you know, had a mine to get their coal from.
Until he was a teenager, Dave's family and everybody else's had outhouses and no running water.
They finally put city water in because from the old mines, actually the water was bad. So you couldn't have a well. You know, you either had to have a cistern or you had to carry your drinking water.
But Dave said he had a pretty normal childhood. All the kids had a bike, a baseball glove, and dads in the mines.
You know, growing up back then, where my dad worked, they didn't have bathhouses. So when he came home, he was black as coal. And he worked a lot of afternoon shift, throughout my childhood. So he was there on the weekends, but through the week when I was in school, you know, I never seen dad.
When he graduated, Dave said he was offered a scholarship to play baseball in Arizona, but he turned it down.
Back then, your parents were different. I mean, once you turned of age, it was time to get out of the house, get a job, and move on with life's work.
And in the early 1970s, a kid right out of high school could make a solid middle-class wage.
It was just so easy to get that job and go on and have money. And back then at 18, 19 years old, you're thinking about girls and drinking and, you know, and everything else. So college kind of just got put out of the way.
For nearly his whole career, Dave worked at the Cumberland Mine in Greene County. Today, it's still a productive underground mine. Dave described coal mining as building a little city underground. There are roads, lights, rail lines that run between different neighborhoods, all of it driven by a sense of purpose and exploration.
You step somewhere where no one has ever stepped before. You know, when that coal's extracted and you move ahead, nobody's ever been there before. You are the first person to touch that area of the earth.
Dave said it was a good living, but he told his kids there would be no fourth-generation coal miners. He held up his hands. On each, he's missing the first knuckle on one of his fingers from two different accidents.
It's a dangerous job. It's a hard job. It's a dirty job. You know, all my friends have basically the same ailments as me. We always have some type of black lung. We're all on breathing machines at night from sleep apnea, which is brought on by the coal dust in your lungs.
As we talked, Dave tempered anything he thought might sound like complaining by pointing out he made these decisions. He worked for the life he has, and yeah, it took a toll on him. But he wanted to make a good living for his family and put his two kids through college, and he did. End of story. What stings is what happened after he retired. Like Dave said, coal mining is a dangerous, physically demanding job. Traditionally, even when coal miners weren't making a lot of money, they were guaranteed top-of-the-line health care. Later, pension benefits were added. In union mines like Dave's, pensions and healthcare were frequent bargaining chips between companies and their employees.
We can't give you a matching 401k because you have guaranteed pension and healthcare. We can't give you a dollar an hour raise. We can only give you 25 cents because you have guaranteed pension and healthcare.
Coal companies normally fund miners' benefits. But as the industry declined, some companies filed for bankruptcy. Through court proceedings, many shed their obligations to pay into those funds. And that's left Dave's union, the United Mine Workers of America, scrambling to cover its retirees. Congress recently acted to protect miners' health care, but the future of their pensions is unclear. Dave sat on the back porch. He and Sandy love it out there. A wind chime kept time with the breeze. When the grandkids visit, which is often, they love to play baseball, and so does Dave, as much as his lungs will let him. Saying Dave loves his grandchildren is an understatement.
Maybe you have more patience when you're older. You're not working all the time. You have really time to spend and become close to them. You know, and the hugs and kisses from grandchildren are just, they're just unreal, Margaret. It is the greatest feeling that I've ever had. Like I said, you know, my children, I love them, but love for a grandchild is just a little bit different.
Dave watched the dogs run back and forth in the yard.
But I come out here on the porch and said, I'll take my Kindle, try to do a Sudoku, read a book, and the mind just keeps going. It just keeps going off in other directions.
Dave said he's a worrier. And facing the risk of losing his pension, everything he's worked for, the house, the peace and quiet, the time and money to spend on his grandchildren, is in jeopardy.
I mean, my American dream was to work 40 years, to be promised a pension, to be promised health care, to be able to go on a vacation every year, to be able to take our grandchildren wherever we want to, do with them whatever we want to. And now everything's on hold. You know, it's just been taken away. And yeah, the American dream is basically gone. And if it happens to us, it could happen to everybody.
If his and Sandy's parents are any indication, Dave figures they have a few good years before they get sick. And in the last year or so, Dave has spent a lot of time on buses, traveling to Washington, D.C. with the United Mine Workers to lobby Congress to protect their benefits. Like a lot of his friends, Dave watched his dad die of black lung. They tell each other their fathers would be rolling in their graves if they knew what was happening.
We don't feel that we're asking for anything that we don't deserve and work for all our life. I believe in promises. If I make you a promise, I'm going to keep it. They made us a promise and they reneged on it.
For many younger miners today, the expectations have changed. As the industry has contracted in recent years, especially with the increasing demand for natural gas, jobs have gotten harder to come by. And when coal mining hit a low point nationwide in 2015, a lot of workers were laid off and had to find other work. Like Josh Beltowski. Today, he runs his own logging business, and Margaret spent some time with him at his job.
I first met Josh back at the end of 2015. It was a few weeks after he'd left the coal mines, and at the time, he seemed pretty glum. He'd wanted to work underground since he was a kid, and then, when he'd finally worked his way in, the market tanked. When he and his wife walked me out that evening, Josh took me over to his garage. Inside, he showed me the logging truck he'd just bought. That was more than a year ago, so I was excited to see Josh in his new element. Instead of meeting him out in the woods or at the lumber mill, Josh said it would be easiest to pick me up. He told me to park at the abandoned restaurant across from the gas station in Burnside, about 2 hours east of Pittsburgh. That would give him enough room to turn around and get back on the road. I'd forgotten just how big the truck is.
Josh is pulling in. That is a big truck.
A 35,000-pound truck, to be exact. As he climbed down from the cab, Josh was grinning from ear to ear. A big logo on both doors read, Josh Beltowski Logging.
That was a month or two into starting things up, and just kind of tied everything in, made it official, you know? Yeah, I was out and about, you know, doing the work and making the money, but it just wasn't the same with his name on the truck, you know?
Josh bought the business from an older guy who was ready to retire. He's made some changes, but he's still an independent contractor. He hauls logs for a bunch of different clients, going back and forth from the woods to the mill. I asked if he remembered the first time he drove the truck.
The first day I drove it, well, it would have been, yeah, I remember. It would have been when I brought it home from his house. It was a pretty cool feeling, you know, knowing that it was mine. You know, this was my career, you know, hopefully. Anyway, God willing, this was what I was going to do for the rest of my life.
Josh considers himself lucky to have the work. He's a trained heavy equipment mechanic, and he loves being outside. Josh said he doesn't like sitting still.
I like getting stuff done. I like the satisfaction of a finished product, a finished day, you know. I like setting my goal in the morning.
That's how he was in the mines, too.
I like coming out of there knowing that I loaded more than the crew before me or the shift before me, you know, or loaded more than we did yesterday, you know, compare ourselves to ourselves instead of somebody else, you know. I mean, always bettering ourselves. We were always staying busy and always getting stuff done, and that's what I like to do.
These days, Josh usually gets up around 3:30 in the morning or so and tries to get out of the house by 4:30. Sometimes, if the weather is good and there's a lot of work, he'll haul all night, get a few hours sleep, and go right back out again.
I have too many hobbies to not have an income, you know? Unless they're going to start giving stuff free. Hunting and fishing and golfing, I mean, it's not cheap, you know? I don't know what I'd do without a job. That's my biggest worry.
Right now, Josh is helping to clear land for a strip mine.
It was a nice forest a couple days ago, and now it's getting destroyed, you know? But those are jobs, and those are resources that we have the technology and ability to harvest, you know, to use. And that's just, I don't want to see them get cut down either, but I do because that's what I do for a living. So, you know, I wish they grew faster, put it that way. I wish you could cut one down and have another one in 2 weeks, you know. That'd be great for me, but that's not the way it works. So just gotta do what you do.
Josh turned the truck into the woods and onto a rutted dirt path. The cab jolted back and forth. Before heading up to the landing, where cutting crews piled the logs to be hauled, Josh got on his radio.
How about you, Smoke?
Yeah.
You on your way out, buddy?
Yeah, where are you at, Joey?
I'm just coming past the houses here. What's the best place for me to stop? I'll let you come through since you're loaded. How far out are you?
Oh,
10-4. We try and communicate, you know what I mean? Coming down these goat paths like this, nice to know where everybody's at.
Josh spends most of his days alone now, except for those radio exchanges, or maybe crossing paths at the mill. He misses the camaraderie of mining.
Yeah, that's probably number one thing I miss. You know, I still have a little bit of it, but nothing to the caliber that I was used to. I mean, it's definitely something that I would enjoy having back, but oh well. I have Froggy 98 now.
Froggy 98 is the country music station in this part of the state and one of the few reliable points on the dial. Josh said he often hears job advertisements on the radio.
Put it this way, everybody that wants to work that I was with in the mines, everyone that was a decent worker, a good worker, has moved on and found another job.
But Josh's wife, Whit, told me if her husband could clone himself, there'd be one Josh in the logging truck and another Josh mining coal.
I'd love to, though. I'd love to just take a day and go down and do it again, you know? Bolt another cut or mine another cut.
When Josh walked me out to my car that evening, he pointed out some land he and Whit own across the street. It's thick with trees. He said someday he hopes to log the land with his own cutting crew, maybe get another truck. We said goodbye and Josh headed inside for dinner, though he wouldn't stay long. The weather was good and there was money to be made. He planned to haul logs off the strip mine all night. Josh doesn't like to sit still.
And that wraps up our show. Be sure to check out the photos of people and places you heard about on this episode of Grapple. You can find the photos online at keystonecrossroads.org/grapple. Grapple is produced by Keystone Crossroads in association with Cuvenda Media. Support for Keystone Crossroads comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. The music on our show is composed by Tony Trove and Mike Vivas. Special thanks to our reporter, Margaret J. Krause, and WHYY's Al Banks for engineering our show, and Charlie Kyer for his help post-production. Our executive producer is Stephanie Marudis of Cuvenda Media, and I'm Naomi Sturoban, editor of Keystone Crossroads. Thanks for listening.